You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
We're away into episode number... We do this every time. I reckon it's 36, is it?
It's 36.
Unbelievable. Got that right.
It's right there on the sheet in front of you.
It is right there. Big week, big weekend.
Yes, it has been a big weekend.
Well, as the president of the Parkside Football Club.
Yep, that's right. It's been 500 days since the juniors and the seniors have been playing football. And this weekend, they're all out. It was practice match central and a carnival type atmosphere around the community, which was fantastic to see.
First goal was kicked and crowd went wild.
Look at that sound effects.
Sound effects. Wow. Unbelievable.
And it was just amazing to see. Smiles on people's faces. And as of right now, end of March 2021, there's no coronavirus in our state of Victoria.
That is amazing, isn't it?
There's plenty of coronavirus popping up everywhere else.
Yeah.
But it almost feels normal in Victoria, doesn't it? For the first time in a long, long time.
Yeah, sure does.
Feel normal to you?
Oh, it absolutely feels so much closer to normal than we have felt in the last, I don't know, 14 months. But, yeah, it is feeling good. Hey, what were the crowds like at the local footy?
Amazing.
Were they?
Yeah. Because you had the games playing and you had the teams who had just finished and the teams that were about to play all lining the boundaries, supporting their older or... Yeah, exactly.
Right.
The older or the younger teams as they were watching them. So it was just great to see.
Yeah, that's amazing. The other thing that's happened,
yeah,
international travel.
Yes, that has reopened into our great state of Victoria, so we may no longer be COVID-free, which will be interesting to see how that plays out. Let's see if the hotel quarantine system works a little better this time around, Blake.
If you could go jump on a plane tomorrow, you know, get the three kids, I was going to say 85 kids, you've only got three, get the three kids, jump in the plane, where would you go?
And if there was no coronavirus or if...
Yeah, no coronavirus.
Oh, no coronavirus.
Any destination in the world, where would you go?
So I've been to Japan once and I'd love to go back to Japan. Mm. Love the States. Love Europe. Been to Africa. I'd love to go back there. Actually, you know what? Right now I'd take just about anywhere because I've been all through Southeast Asia as well. I've been very lucky in my life to see a bit of the world.
Yeah.
I think probably Southeast Asia. That's probably where I'd head to first. Vietnam, Thailand, somewhere like that. Mm. A bit of warmth. Mm. But I love Europe. So somewhere in Western Europe would be great to spend a few weeks.
Jeez, you're having,
Spain.
You're having a bit of everything.
I think I just want to get out.
You do. Yeah. Amazing. All right, who is this week's guest on the Doolanders?
Well, it is our great honour to have the CEO of Intrepid Travel join us, James Thornton. And just a great time in the world and, you know, in history to actually have someone who's the head of a really, really big and important travel company who went from lots of revenue to zero revenue. And when I mean zero revenue, it is literal zero revenue in the space of a few weeks once the world shut down. And he's had an incredible journey. He was incredibly young CEO, 35.
Yeah.
To be to go up through the ranks that quickly. So obviously very intelligent person who loves the industry.
Here he is. Here he is. Here's James Thornton.
Blake, do you like stories of people doing?
I love stories of people doing, Nick.
Well, if you out there like stories of people doing and you want us to make more stories of people doing, then like this podcast, subscribe, and tell your mates, because the more people we have listening, the more episodes we can make, and that's better for everyone out there who's doing or wants to do.
And as Arnold would say, do it.
I thought he said I'll be back.
Hey, James, welcome to the Doolanders, mate. How are you?
Fantastic, Blake. It's great to be here with you both.
Thank you, mate. Nick, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Blake.
You are looking decidedly relaxed tonight.
And normally I'm...
not relaxed. It must be James is...
he's very calm.
He is calm.
And he said
calm.
How healthy I look.
He did.
In comparison to you.
That is true. James...
He also told me he loved me in French.
Yeah. That's good. We'll get to that in a minute. Mate, on the D-Landers, we like to ask our guests, what do you do?
Sure.
So what do you do?
What do I do? I think one of the best jobs in the world, certainly best jobs in the world pre-COVID. I'm chief executive of Intrepid Travel. We're the world's largest travel B Corp. We are setting out to try and become the best travel company for the world. I've been lucky to lead the business for the course of the last 5 years. Englishman living in Australia, married to a wife, Natalie, got a young son, Art. So, that's me.
That's what you do. Now, I can't wait to dig into this. Usually on the D-Landers, we like to hark back to the start of your life. Sure. And we'll step through, you know, how you've got to where you are today. But when we think about the impact that COVID-19 has had right across the globe, there can't be any other industry, aside from the health industry, that has been more affected than the travel business. Mm. Can you take us back to, and I don't know when it was in 2020, to the moment you thought, holy shit, this is really going to hurt our business. When was that?
Friday the 13th of March, about 4:30 p.m.
Right.
Friday the 13th, that's pretty ominous.
It is,
We were in a leadership team meeting, had my core reports with me. The world was shutting down around us. You know, we'd gone from kind of China in January. In fact, I remember the AFR calling in mid-January for an interview talking about this coronavirus and will it have an impact on the travel industry? And I was, you know, almost laughing and dismissing it because January was a record sales month for Intrepid. We did $55 million. We'd never done more bookings in our history. And yet we're sat there on Friday the 13th of March facing the real possibility of the world essentially closing down around us. And at the time we had nearly 3,000 customers all around the world. We had staff
on trips.
Yep. We had 40, so we have staff based all around the world. Suddenly someone came running into the room and said, Scott Morrison is closing the international border and has told Australians they need to come home. And that was that kind of silenced the room at that point. You know, we were having heated discussions around how do we continue to give customers confidence to want to book, because obviously bookings had kind of tailed from $55 million of record sales in January to virtually kind of ceasing overnight, and then customers were contacting around refunds.
Yeah.
Customers were based all over the world wanting assurance around getting home. Borders were literally shutting around the world overnight. And so, yeah, I think at that 4:30 p.m. kind of silenced the room when Scott Morrison said he wanted all Australians to come home, we'd be shutting the international border. Pretty prohibitive as a global travel company.
Yeah. So what did you do next?
So next, it's actually ironic because there wasn't too much we could do at that exact moment. We actually went out for dinner as a team, and I think we knew we had some very, very big decisions ahead of us in terms of what we're going to do with global operations. And we woke up in the morning and a few of our kind of key competitors had started to say they were going to suspend operations. And we were literally starting to get, you know, I think it's Peru just basically said we're shutting the border. So you had, you know, these people in Peru couldn't actually get them out of the country, let alone try and encourage them to get to the airport. So I actually called my leadership team to my house on the afternoon of Saturday, the 14th of March. And a decision that should be a very material decision, which is to suspend global operations for the first time in our 31 history, was actually a very easy kind of no-brainer decision to make because you had no choice.
Yeah.
So then you kind of switch very much into crisis mode of trying to repatriate these nearly 3,000 passengers from around the world. And actually, it might sound strange, but that was a seamless operation because for a global tour operator that's operating trips to 120 countries around the world, you're dealing with such, you know, diverse situations every single day that we're very well trained and versed in crisis management because Crises happen.
Yeah.
Earthquakes in Nepal take place.
Yeah.
Coups take place in countries when you have passengers. So actually it was quite seamless then over the course of the next kind of week or two of getting the passengers home, which was obviously our first priority. But your mind very quickly switched then into, we're a company with no revenue. We're not only a company with no revenue, we're a company that needs to refund a significant portion of the revenue that we've already earned. And we've no idea when we're going to start to generate material revenues going forward. Now, this isn't something that obviously then just, that wasn't the 14th of March. We're suddenly starting to work out what to do, because probably about a month beforehand, towards maybe not a month, 3 weeks beforehand, towards the end of February, I'd had a call from our chair, who's our co-founder, and he'd said to me, hey, Alan Joyce is meeting with his leadership team twice a week and they're in crisis management mode. I reckon we need to be in the same.
Right.
And I remember it being a real dawning thing for me to say, hey, we've got to get ahead of this thing, because anything was possible. We didn't think in 3 weeks, the world would have shut down, but it enabled us to prepare really well. And so we started to look at our cost bases. We started to get a very, very careful eye on our cash management situation. And so it enabled us then, as soon as we'd suspended global operations, to really effectively move through the different crisis elements we had to manage. And sadly, that was downsizing a significant portion of our staff. It's very tightly managing our overheads, starting to go into very tight cash management, working through customer refunds. It was a strange time, and you obviously had no idea when it was going to return. And, the first time we shut global operations, I think I'm going to get this wrong now, but I think we shut it for 6 weeks, and we thought, well, 6 weeks we'll shut it. And of course, we're sat here a year later.
Yeah.
And, we've probably run a couple of handfuls of trips in the course of a year. It's a company that turned over $500 million in the year pre-COVID. So, yeah it's been a huge year.
So when you got up on the morning of the 15th of March, the 16th of March, the 17th of March, and went to, I was going to say shave, but looking at your beard, I don't think you have shaved for a year.
I shed a COVID beard. I go, that's a secret. I'd made a thing in the office. I wasn't going to shave until COVID was over. And I've definitely regretted that.
Yeah. Well, you look like Ned Kelly. No, not quite. What did you say to yourself in terms of the way that you were going to show up each day and your thought process around how you needed to be as a leader?
Yeah, probably two things. One, I was waking up every morning and it was like, it wasn't real, to be honest with you. And right. I literally, you wake up in the morning and it was like you had a nightmare. It wasn't real. And then you realized it was real. And you realized you're the CEO of the world's largest global adventure travel company, and you can't operate, and you've got, huge responsibility in terms of, pre-COVID, we had 1,100 office staff. We had $70 million of client credits with us. We've got nearly 1,000 leaders and crew who work with us. We've got communities all over the world who can't rely on our source of business for a form of income. And you've got to show up. So probably one of the main things, the second key thing that I always take is I was going to be open, honest and transparent.
Yep.
And that was just number one. And I think that came from B Corp methodology. Intrepid's a certified B Corp, been a B Corp since 2018. And you're just open, honest and transparent. And that's good news and bad news. And so particularly for when we had bad news, I was going to front up, I was going to be open about it. I wasn't going to sugarcoat it. And I was going to communicate incredibly frequently. Yeah. We used to have company updates once a month. That was me standing in front of the company and talk about what's going on and get some of our senior leaders up. We're having company updates every 2 days for a period of time.
Yeah.
And that's just what we had to do to try and support our people and, show the leadership to try and get through. But,
How often were you just in the middle of the night staring at the ceiling, thinking through the millions of machinations of what could possibly play out or what you had to do? Or do you have an ability to hit the pillow and go?
I had the ability to hit the pillow. I think, again, it comes back to crisis management with Intrepid, because we have gone through quite a lot of things as a global tour operator. I mentioned the Nepal earthquake. We've had passengers impacted by the Malaysian Airlines disaster. A number of years ago, we've had incidents of fatalities in different parts of the world for different reasons, and news channels turning up at your door. So we're kind of well-versed in terms of crisis. And one of the things we're really crystal clear on in a crisis is you can't function 24 hours a day. And so we're a global team. We've got great people all around the world. So it's really imperative that when you go through a crisis, you get your sleep.
Yep.
And so, you know, it's pretty good at kind of being able to fall asleep. You know, undoubtedly, there were times I'd wake up. If I ever wake up, I'd go for a run because that was the best thing for me to kind of clear my head. But yep. But yeah, of course, you know, there were times. But you've got to get your sleep and rest during a crisis.
Talk to us about the what do you consider the personal cost through this has been, because like this has been an unrelenting situation, I would imagine. Day in, day out, 24 hours a day for, what, coming on a year?
Mm-hmm.
What's been the cost to you?
I don't think of a cost to me, to be honest, Blake. I don't think of a cost to me because I reckon it's really easy when you have a really difficult time to think about things being really terrible and me. But the cost to way more people than me was impacted. You know, our staff have all had reduced financial income.
Yeah.
If they've retained their job, if they haven't retained their job, then, you know, they've had to go out and find new work. And that's devastating for people who had done absolutely nothing wrong to deserve it. Those that have stuck with us have worked on reduced hours with ongoing uncertainty. Our leaders and crew have had no income. You know, our communities around the world that are so reliant on tourism have had absolutely nothing. So personal costs, you know, a nice house, beautiful wife, great son, a son who I actually hardly ever saw because I'd spent 7 or 8 months of the year traveling around the world. And now I've spent a year with him, actually growing up with him and engaging with him. So yeah, personal cost to me, I mean, it's been stressful, but I've actually learned an enormous amount professionally. And I just think it's really, you've got to try and take the positives out of every situation. And that's what I've tried to do. But don't get me wrong, there have been times that you've sat there and gone, gee, what did we do to deserve going through this situation?
Yeah. All right. Let's switch gears. Let's look at the positives.
Sure.
So talk to us about Intrepid and
the
Phoenix coming out of the ashes here. Yeah. Like when you think about the business and the rebuild of the business, are you building the business to recreate what you had, or will it be something different?
Yeah, it'd be a mixture of both, Blake. I mean, we were the global market leader in sustainable experience rich travel. And we tried to do two things: grow the market, what we call sustainable experience rich travel, which is what people would have known as adventure travel, but really it's about having experiences and doing it in a sustainable fashion. The second thing we've been trying to do is to operate a business that continues to balance having a purpose and delivering a profit. And I have this real fundamental kind of core driver belief in business. I want to change the way people do business. And there's this old fashioned thinking, which is if you want to be a commercial success, you've got to be an oil company pumping terrible things into the earth, and that's how you do well, because it's the sacrifice of other things.
Yep.
And if you want to do good for the world, then you've got to be an NGO, and you actually can't, you know, do well. And I just fundamentally disagree with that notion. I think it's super old-fashioned, it's outdated. I think B Corps around the world, which is a growing movement of over 4,000 companies now, are proving that there is a different way to do business, and that you can be a very strong, commercially successful company. And Intrepid had 20% compound average growth rate in profitability in the last 4 years, 18% compound average growth rate in top line revenue. This is a business that's 31 years old.
Yeah.
But we've also become a certified B Corp. We have verified science-based targets to work towards a 1.5 degree temperature rise. We are the first tour operator in the world to ban elephant riding. You know, we raised a significant amount of money through our foundation. We crowdsource animal welfare toolkits to provide to other tour operators. So you can do all those things. But the great thing is that the more we do in the purpose space, I've always found the more it helps us grow. Our profile gives us global media coverage. Yep. The more that helps us grow, the more we can do the good things in the purpose space. So that's what we're going to try and keep doing. But of course, the way in which we go about doing business will undoubtedly be different. You know, COVID has been an accelerant, hasn't it? It's been an accelerant of e-commerce. It's an accelerant in terms of there's been some destruction of the retail travel industry in you know, key places like Australia and New Zealand, where we'd get a lot of our business. And the way in which people will travel in the future, I think, will be slightly different.
In what way?
Well, I think initially people will travel more locally and domestically because they'll be forced to primarily. And I think, you know, also climate change, we'll talk about that separately with B Corp, but climate change is fundamentally a worse disaster than COVID is. And that sounds hot, weird to sit here now, but if we don't do something about climate change in 20 years, we won't have a world to show people.
Yeah.
And that will, you know, there will be no travel industry then.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've got to keep evolving and moving.
And do you think, you know, one thing that COVID's done is made people really reflect about what's important in their lives? Mm. And do you think that your style of travel will, you know, people will be more interested in soaking up the culture of, you know, different destinations rather than hopping from, you know, five-star hotel to five-star hotel? Do you see that there could be a, you know, a greater want and demand for your style of thing?
I think so. I think people have missed the connection with each other. We've been stuck at home, haven't we?
Yeah.
We've been forced to be stuck at home. And what's the one thing you kind of miss is that intimate connection. And saying to Nick earlier, back in the office day, you got the connection with people. You're talking around the coffee machine. You're getting to know what's going on in people's lives. It's the thing you're just not able to do when you're in a virtual environment. And I think people want to get a better understanding of what's going on in the world. And increasingly people want two things. They want experiences, which is, you know, to get out and do something different. And secondly, to purchase through sustainable companies. You know, particularly younger people, millennials, are wanting this sustainable thing. So I think for Intrepid, which is experiencing cyclical demand destruction at the moment, it's not structural demand destruction, which I think is the business travel industry, because I think that's changed forever. But I think for a company like Intrepid that provides experiences and sustainability, we're extremely well placed to be able to come back. But we can't just come back as the old company. We've got to keep evolving, like I was saying earlier.
Yeah. Before we move on to you, and we are going to go back to the start and find out, one, how you became this smart, and two, a bunch of other stuff about your sports prowess. But when you think about your team and, you know, you reflect back over the last 12 months, you know, was there anything that surprised you about how they reacted through the whole crisis? Or were they that well drilled because of who you are and the way that you operate that they performed as you thought they would?
I don't think it surprised me, but it made me again realize the importance of just having fantastic people around you. And, you know, I think it's one of the things as you grow up, sometimes you can be intimidated to bring in great people around you because I think you're going to show you up and it's the biggest load of rubbish ever.
Yeah.
I recruited a CFO just before we went into COVID. He's an ASX 100 listed CFO, used to running billions of dollars and, you know, massive companies. And that was because we were moving from 500 million to a billion to try and become the world's first billion-dollar adventure travel company and list. He actually, you know, was just such a sensational hire in terms of getting us the composure of leadership and being able to manage through, you know, your cash flow forecasts across 40 different countries and then lead us through a capital raise process alongside myself. We recruited a general counsel just before COVID. Again, she came in and just did a phenomenal job in terms of managing, you know, all of the different things we had to go through. How do you manage your terms and conditions, your force majeure clause, your dealings with the ACCC? And, you know, it was a real, you know, again, a great reminder of get great people around you, empower them. And it's cliche, but it was just so, so, so true for us. And I've just been so proud of those people. And, you know, I think we try and really look after them. And I think we've done a good job of that in the last few years. And they do an amazing job of looking after us and the business.
Yeah, nice.
How do you attract people of that sort of caliber who are coming in? I mean, you're running a massive business, but in their eyes, it's a small business.
Sure.
What's the value proposition that you're giving them?
Because we stand for something. I know that sounds a bit cliche, but we stand for something. And I don't think a lot of companies don't stand for something. And, you know, Nick, we don't pay the best salaries in the world. In fact, we tend to go at about 25th percentile of a base salary because it's about what we can afford as a pretty low margin travel company. But what we do is we give experience and really empower people. With our senior people in particular, we've got 61 staff shareholders. And so we really try and share the equity journey. And that's been a really important thing of Daryl and Manch, our founders. And I think one of the key successes of attracting those people, because you're working for your own company and nothing beats working for your own company with those key people. And then, you know, we try and have some fun. We try not to take ourselves too seriously. It's like this kind of casual intensity. We want to have fun and we want to be approachable and we want to, you know, do some cool things, but we also want to be like really intense in terms of our delivery and, you know, making stuff happen. And we're quite competitive in that nature. And, you know, we've been able to tend to appeal to some quite good people. And actually, B Corp's been one of the biggest changes for us. People want to work for a B Corp.
Yeah.
Hey, Blake, did you just write down the two words casual intensity?
Well, I was just about to ask James.
Because I did.
Have you trademarked that?
have.
Is that your saying? Where'd you get that from?
I read it 3 or 4 years ago and I just thought, guys, kind of backs me up because I never really taken myself too seriously. You know, I like to really like to have fun and, you know, I've kind of, yeah, like to have fun and like to you know, enjoy myself. And but I really love winning and I really like changing things and making things happen. And yeah, there's just this notion of casual intensity. I kind of like it.
Yeah, I think there's a T-shirt in that. I mean, tell us about, has travel always been in your blood? If you think back to your early years.
Yeah, definitely, Blake. I mean, I just had this strange fascination with the work, with the globe, the atlas, you know. I was always, I can remember at grandparents' house just having this strange thing at 8 or 9 years old, being able to reel off capital cities of countries. And I don't know, I just found it fascinating that there were different cultures out there. And then and I'd never been anywhere. You know, we didn't have, you know, we grew up and we had some lovely family and but we traveled domestically in the UK predominantly. We went to Wales on holiday. So we didn't go overseas specifically. But then my dad at about 11, 12, started working overseas, went to the US, then into Brazil in time, kind of moved around India, China. And I think his kind of exposure to different cultures and different environments and coming back and sharing those stories with me. And then just kind of, you know, my thing was I was going to, you know, go to school, do university, and then just go and travel the world and do that for 6 months. And it didn't matter what job I was going to go off, I was going to travel around the world. And I've just always had this love and fascination of the world and the globe. And it's a small place, to be honest with you. It's a small place.
The globe is?
The globe's a small place, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We were talking a couple of years back, and Qantas, was it Qantas that sent you a Christmas present?
yeah, Qantas. For the last 4 years, they've sent me a Christmas present, I think.
Because how many flights had you been on that particular year?
Yeah, probably, 130, 140 sectors in the year. So, yeah. Spend quite a bit of money with Qantas. Been a bit lean this year. Christmas present didn't come this year.
No, it wouldn't have. So the other thing that did you think about, you were pretty good at footy, at soccer. You played semi-professional. Did you ever think that you'd make it?
I don't think I was ever naive enough to think I'd make it. I think I always would have loved the idea of making it, but I don't think I was very fortunate. I had a few options. I kind of did okay at school and I was, I was with a good group of friends. And so it was kind of going up and playing against kids who, you know, if they didn't make it to soccer, there wasn't going to be a lot going on. And I just didn't have that kind of burning desire enough to make it happen. And, you know, I'd go through games where I'd be outstanding and then go through games where I'd just be terrible. And I just didn't quite have it. And I think, you know, I always find it funny talking to ex-sports people because they're like, oh, the reason I didn't make it is because I got injured. Well, the reason I didn't make it because I wasn't good enough.
What about art? Like your son Art, I've seen him. He looks like he has the makings of a professional footballer.
Yeah, he's pretty keen. He's pretty keen and he's certainly, you know, talking that way, that's for sure.
Is
so
he?
We'll see how it goes.
He's talking it up early.
He's talking it up early, for sure. So he's 8 years old. Yeah. He's pretty into his soccer, kind of any sports, but yeah, loves his soccer. So I think his dad's had a bit of influence there.
Who's goalie most, you or Nat?
It's definitely me, definitely me. Nat's pretty talented at sport too, an amazing tennis player. So definitely me.
Mate, you went to uni and you walked out and became a
private client asset manager. Yeah.
Yeah. A private client asset manager.
Yeah.
What's the outcome that you're trying to deliver as a private client asset manager?
Well, you're trying to make rich people richer, and that's pretty soul destroying as far as I was concerned. There's kind of the story was I went to Loughborough University in the UK. It's kind of the equivalent of the Aussie Institute of Sport. So I was lucky enough to do a joint honours degree of geography and sports science. Geography, the thing I kind of enjoyed and was okay at school. Sport, my absolute love. Combined them together, amazing 3 years. But I really didn't have a great picture of what I was going to become. You know, I was going to be a teacher, a coach. Wasn't really sure. And so while I was at uni, I applied for lots of different internships, came across a finance company. They took me on as a private client asset manager in private client asset management. And I kind of, you know, I was doing portfolio assistant and supporting the managers. And it was just a good way to earn some income. And then I was going traveling around the world and they said, well, when you come back from traveling around the world, do you want to come in and study to become one? So that was what I did. It was not through choice or desire. It was because I need to earn some money to go traveling. And when I came back from traveling, I needed some money. So did it for a few years, but you know, quite quickly realized that I was about to spend the next 40 years of my life making rich people richer. And as far as I was concerned, you kind of need to do something you're passionate about. And I didn't have any passion for it. So started looking for jobs in travel and sport. And that's where I came across a little company called Intrepid Travel.
Yeah. So you joined and you thought you'd stick it out for a couple of years, travel the world, go and get a real job.
Yeah, indeed.
How many years later?
16.
Here you are.
16, yeah. That definitely turned into one.
It's been an amazing journey and a life changer. Mm. Where did you meet Nat, your wife?
Yes, I met Nat at Intrepid. So I joined in 2005. Got the opportunity to come to Australia for a sales conference, met Nat for the first time. I like to pretend that she wanted to hang out with me. She claims fiercely that she didn't. I'm sure she was right.
Right.
And then I actually moved down in, got offered a year's contract in the middle of 2007 to come to Australia for a year. And as someone in their kind of early to mid-20s by then, it was, an opportunity not to be missed, and kind of left home with one suitcase and met Nat relatively quickly. She was in marketing, I was in sales. We started hanging out, which was great. But then after probably 8 or 9 months, she decided that she wanted to not work in the same company as the guy she was dating. So she headed off and did some great stuff at Swiss Vitamins and a few other companies.
Her opinion changed on that.
It did change, yeah. Well, we're lucky enough 4 years ago, five years ago now, Nat and I were able to become shareholders at Intrepid. When we took the business back under the private ownership of Daryl and Jeff, our founders, after being with TUI. As shareholders, I think it kind of changes the mechanism. And so Nat came back into the business. She's a fantastic marketer. You know, she's an amazing travel marketer. And, you know, we need someone with her talents to help us go on the growth journey we did. And she's played as much of an integral role in that as you know, I have and so many other of our leaders have. So, it's pros and cons of working together.
So talk to us about that.
Sure.
So last year, you're in it up to your eyeballs.
Yeah.
You're there trying to keep the thing afloat.
Sure.
Nat's there thinking exactly the same thing and trying to do exactly the same thing. Could you turn off from Intrepid?
No, I don't think you do turn off. I don't know. Every leader's different, aren't they? I didn't really turn off. We talked about it a lot, and it's too all-consuming for us. You know, Nat's got an association with Intrepid that I think goes back to 2001, so it's 20 years.
Yep.
You know, we've become very good friends with Daryl and Jeff and their families. And you know, Intrepid's in our blood. You know, and we both love it. It's a passion. It's a lot of what we are, and we're incredibly invested in trying to make it work. So. Yeah, unfortunately, we were in situations and kind of often still do where you're talking about things at home and, you know, it's not ideal. It's probably not the way you want it to be. But on the other hand, we're super passionate about something and that's pretty cool. And
that is cool. Yeah. It's in you, as you said. It's in your blood.
Yeah.
So you're the first non-founder MD at 31.
Yep.
Just a boy
with a 3-week-old son living in the UK. And because we've gone back to the UK in 2011. Nat and I went over, married here, so went over there, run global sales, head of UK and Europe division, and then one of the founders decided he didn't want to be MD anymore of Intrepid, and I put my name forward and managed to get the job, and we had a 3-week-old little boy. We're living in England. We'd only been there kind of 13 months with our stuff there, and we were busy packing up and then back to Melbourne. So 31 with first MD, which was. Yeah, interesting.
Super cool. Board director at 34.
Yeah.
Group CEO at 35.
Yep.
That's a big 4 years.
Yep.
Were you sprinting every day? Like in your mind, were you thinking what's next?
Yeah. I wasn't thinking what was next. I was every single job Daryl Way, the chair and co-founder, has ever given me, probably never been ready for, to be honest, the truth. And I think he'd recognise that. But I think maybe saw, you know, like a bit of himself and Manch in me. And, you know, I just was just work incredibly hard, ask loads of questions, listen, you know, like two ears, one mouth. Mm. And just really kind of dedicated to try and deliver results. And I think one of the really good things at Intrepid is it's a company where if you fail, it's okay, as long as you put your hand up and own it. If you don't put your hand up and own it, it's a problem for us. You learn from your mistakes and then you know, move forward and you ultimately become better from those mistakes. And I've made so many of those mistakes. You know, big profit downgrade in 2014, lost one of our biggest clients in 2012. But you know, every time I was kind of, well, what did you learn? What are you going to do differently? You've owned it. This is how we move forward. So, yeah, that's kind of what I've tried to do and adapt with the guys.
Yeah. We touched on B Corp earlier. It's B Corp month. What's the next evolution of B Corp? Do you have a sense of what that looks like? Is it about growing its footprint? Clearly, it's that purpose-led organization is really, and there's never a better time, really, is there? I think people are going to reflect and go, does the money matter or do I want to make a difference and make an impact? What's the next evolution? Do you know?
Obviously, there's a growth of the B Corp movement. So yep. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head. 3,500, 4,000 companies now. It's grown its profile quite strongly under Andrew Davis here in Australia. He's doing a fantastic job. You got more material companies increasingly becoming B Corps by the moment. Kathmandu, you've got ESOP, Bank Australia. So Future Super, there's some really great companies. So I think it's growing the profile. And you know, it's still small here. North America, it's got the biggest presence.
Right.
The Patagonias, Ben and Jerry's, yep. Body Shops, Natura's. So there's increasingly bigger businesses. So I think you want to grow the profile. I think the second thing is the understanding of what it means, though. Because again, if B Corp, I think people continue to associate too much with that kind of almost ultra-left kind of NGO. It's just about doing good by the world. It is about benefiting all stakeholders. And that's just really, really critical. And it's really hard as well. It's actually, you know, you've got to benefit your shareholders, benefit the communities you operate in, benefit your people, benefit your customers, benefit your partners. And that's the methodology of what you've got to try and do. It is not just about, you know, giving your money away to do good. You've got to be a commercial success. And businesses that are commercial, sustainable success can ultimately, I believe, then invest more in purpose. And the more you invest in the purpose, like I said earlier, that drives your growth. And I've feel that's a bit of a flywheel and that's quite cyclical and yeah, it does pretty good by us.
So clearly there's businesses that aren't B Corps.
Yeah.
What do the detractors say about B Corps?
I think detractors say about B Corp, I just don't need to do it. One of the difficulties here in Australia is it's not legislation. So it needs to be written into Australian legislation, business legislation. So ultimately there is an issue by the fact that according to kind of company's law here, we should do everything in the sole interest of the shareholder. And that's not what obviously we do. We do it absolutely in the interest of our shareholder, but also we consider other stakeholders in our decision-making framework. Now that isn't law in Australia.
Yep.
It's law in many other countries around the world. I'm probably going to get wrong. UK, US, certain other countries, it's legislation. But it's not here. And so that's some of the detraction. But I think that's, to be honest, I just think that's a bit of a cop-out.
Yeah. I would think the detraction is it's harder to run a I think it is. It's harder.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you think about that decision framework that you're talking about. Mm. There's more boxes to tick.
Yeah.
When you are operating an organisation.
Yeah.
When you're beholden to your...
It makes you more exposed, you know, when things go tough. And we make mistakes.
Mm.
We do not always get things right. People think, oh, because you're a B Corp, you don't make mistakes. Well, that's complete rubbish. You know, we get things wrong. For example, when we went through COVID, we're still going through COVID, back in April, we were too slow in responding to some of our customers that wanted refunds. And, you know, we kind of said, well, you can't be a B Corp, you've been too slow to give me a refund. Well, that's just, we made a mistake.
Yeah.
We didn't act quickly enough.
Yeah.
And we should have acted better, but we were going through a, you know, disaster and removing too many people, and actually we had to get a global crisis team in place, and then we reacted within 5 days and we got it right. But it's hard. It's really hard.
Sorry, Matt, you were going to say?
Well, now I'm lost. Thanks.
That's right. That's right. So you talk about Intrepid, about being hungry, humble and smart.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so...
I know what it means, yeah, but sure, what does it mean to you?
No, it's we talk about we want people at Intrepid to be hungry, humble and smart. They're the kind of core characteristics that we're looking for. Hungry in the sense of, you know, willing to learn, willing to work hard, willing to take on new things and new ideas. Humble is very much the recognition that it's a team effort to make things work. Yep, you've got to be great at doing what you're doing, but you will not get where we need to get to without being a team.
Yep.
And so we really, you know, when we're not big fans of people that it's all about me. We really want that kind of, you know, team environment. And then smart does not mean that you have to be an MBA. And I think feel really strongly about that. And I want to be crystal clear. I'm not a smart guy by education. There are so many smarter people than me. But smarts can often mean, you know, common sense and EQ and being prepared to learn and to read. I'm really strong in, you know, read and improve and learn and listen, because we don't have all the ideas. And the more we kind of soak up ideas, the more we can have smarts and then be able to kind of push forward. Yeah. So, yeah, hungry, humble, smart's a bit of a thing we look for in our people.
Is there a way to interview for humble?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I don't think so. And you still make mistakes on that, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, we tie all different methodologies now. We do gender splitting on our interview process now. So you've got to have a male or female. We're increasingly talking about blind interviews, blind CVs. But yeah, it's very, very difficult.
Yeah.
What's a blind CV?
Don't see the name.
Oh.
Because we often find unconscious bias affects some of the decision making that we're looking at when we're doing it. So you're starting to look, we haven't installed it yet, but it's something we're considering doing.
Mm. For those people in business, how do you use a mentor? You've had a great mentor along the journey. How do you use that?
Ask a lot of questions, listen a lot, be prepared to learn. And I think one of the things we talk about a little bit is just resilience. So big mentor for me has been Darryl Wade, our co-founder and chair, and he tells it like it is, and sometimes that can be pretty robust, and I don't like to hear what he says, and but you know what, I reckon within 24 hours 9 times out of 10 he's right.
Yeah.
And I've got to kind of, you know, take on that feedback. And you know, there's been times I kind of fought against it, and I'll always tell the classic story with him of, you know, one time I didn't agree with something he was suggesting that would be a good idea to consider looking at, and I wrote, you know, an extensive email about why he was wrong, and he just wrote back.
Did you press go?
Sorry, I stupidly pressed send. You know, right. Being the young, immature person I was, and he said, yeah, you might be right. He goes, but in the time you spent doing that, you could have actually done what we were talking about doing and been the right direction. So, I know that's always been a bit of a learning too.
Yeah. Mate, how do you look after you?
How do I look after me?
Do you bring your A game every day?
Yeah, so running, reading, listening, being with my family, keeping fairly grounded, not taking myself too seriously. That's how I do it. You know, just try and surround myself with decent people, people who tell me exactly what's going on, people who, if I think I'm getting a bit too big for my own boots, you know, we've had some decent success in Intrepid, and sometimes you get carried away and there are people to bring you down pretty quickly, and, you know, they're school friends or the people you've grown up with, your family. And I try and do a lot of running and a lot of reading, and I find those two things really help.
I've got two more questions. Sure. Have you missed the 138 flights?
Yes and no. Yes and no. Yeah, I think I did in the early days, you know, because it becomes so habitual. It was my life, you know. I would probably spend 6 days at home consecutively in a year. And I missed, you know, the global community that we've created in Intrepid. We've got some amazing people all over the world, really great friends and great partnerships, and, you know, lots of people that we really enjoyed working with. And I was super lucky, you know, going to New York every few months, or London or Marrakesh or wherever it would be. So, yeah, I miss it. On the other hand, it's been amazing to be at home, you know, and back to this whole, the personal impact, I've got to spend an amazing amount of time with my son that I've never spent before in his entire life. You prioritize other things, don't you? Around 100Ks a month, or, you know, read some books, or spend some time with friends.
Yeah.
How did you reckon that changes your outlook for, you know, having now spent more time with your son in the last year than you had prior?
Yeah.
How does that change your outlook on the return of normal, whatever that looks like for your travel?
With some trepidation, I think. I'm obviously from the UK, really keen, first thing I can, to go and see my family. Absolutely, it'll be probably 2 years by the time it actually gets to happen. But I'm not desperate to get back on planes, but maybe I don't need to. Maybe I can run a global travel company and not do that. I've got great people. Clearly, I'll need to do things, but maybe it doesn't need me to be on a plane every single week to do that. And I think we can continue to grow the company fairly strongly without necessarily having to be that person that does that.
If money wasn't an object for Nick and I, what one intrepid trip should we take?
And should we take it together or separate?
Yeah,
knowing us both intimately.
Great question. Well, the first thing, intrepid is fantastic value for money. So money does not need that to be an object with great value that for money. True. Excellent prayer price.
Just before you answer, actually, James, what level of intensity do you run at normally? Are you a casual intensity type of guy or a high intensity, low intensity?
You know that I'm casual intensity. I have been to Japan on an intrepid trip.
You have, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, Japan family.
Did the family trip.
Yeah.
I went to Thailand on a Rome trip.
Oh, Rome. Okay, excellent.
Back in the olden days.
Yeah. The best trip I've ever been on, for me, Gorillas, Rwanda, Christmas Day, part of my honeymoon. You know, Rwanda's an amazing country. 25 years ago, going through terrible genocide. You go up to the volcano, small country, you land in Kigali Airport, which is beautiful. You wouldn't think you're in the middle of Africa. You're just like, well, it's better than most English airports, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Go up to the Volcanoes National Park. The national park borders three countries, Democratic Republic Congo, Uganda, Rwanda. You go and trek for anything up to 4 hours to actually meet the gorillas. When you get to be with them, you get an hour with them. It's like nothing I've ever seen in my life. It is hairs on the back of your neck. Seeing them in their natural habitat is just the most unbelievable thing. Nothing compares. Safaris in Masai Mara or Kruger, I've been very lucky to see things like that, but going to see a gorilla in its true natural habitat is amazing. And then Rwanda as a country is pretty amazing given what it's gone through. And just spending time with the people there is pretty cool. So it's a good one for a few days.
Right. Well, look forward to taking that one. Antarctica?
Antarctica, yep, another spectacular destination.
How long have you spent down there?
We did about 3 weeks down there. So we were lucky enough to actually do a fly across, land on King George Island, which is part of the South Shetlands, jump on the ship and then spend the time, Antarctic Peninsula, and then we came back up to the Falklands across Strait Passage. So, yeah, that's a pretty remarkable place to definitely get there. Amazing. Add that to the list.
Amazing.
So in the short term,
yep.
What are the Aussie destinations that we can do with Intrepid?
Well, got trips all over Australia. Well, I'll tell you one really interesting thing is the Kimberleys are completely booked up. So unfortunately, if you want to go to the Kimberleys in 2021, that's a no-go. Kind of Broome, Kimberley area is just jam-packed, can't get availability up there. Lots of, fantastic stuff, particularly kind of active, remote, lots of walking in Tasmania, very popular, drinking the local wine, eating the local food, that's great. Red Centre, Top End, and then little kind of shorter, smaller experiences, little Byron getaways, Yarra Valley getaways. So, yeah, lots of great little unique taster experiences. And to be honest, that's how you can help companies like Intrepid right now, to travel and try and spend your money locally with businesses that are doing it tough because, it's looking increasingly like the government probably won't support us moving forward post-JobKeeper. So, it's tough times.
Yeah. Crystal ball the next... let's say COVID, the vaccine works, continues to dissipate. Crystal ball it for us. Like, it's you were talking about a capital raise a little while, earlier on. What's going on? What's going to happen?
Yeah, so two things. One, what happened travel-wise, who knows, in the lap of the gods.
Yeah.
Australia's taken a policy of elimination. The rest of the world really hasn't, but kind of New Zealand and Taiwan. At some point, Australia will have to consider how it's going to open its borders. It won't do it until the entire population or close to the entire population is vaccinated. Mm. That's due to October. Alan Joyce last week in his half-year results announced that you can book any one of their international destinations effective 31 October. So that seems like a reasonable get, but it's going to change a big, big kind of cultural change from both the federal and state governments that actually means COVID will come into the country because at some point COVID's got to come into the country. Otherwise, the country stays remote. And so whether you treat COVID as, a flu or a whatever it's a pneumonia, whatever it's going to be, but that's the only way you'll reconnect. So end of the year, probably reasonable for Australians to start thinking about international travel. I don't think bubbles will work. I don't see that happening. I think it's too impacted. What it means for Intrepid, Intrepid will survive. Absolutely. We're, you know, a very strong kind of 4 or 5 years. What we've done is we've gone about doing a capital raise process towards the end of last year. We've got a new investor coming into our business, taking a minority stake in the company. We still have full control. They're buying into our strategy and what we're trying to achieve. But, you know, their funds ultimately go towards kind of securing the balance sheet and then transformational capital to be able to grow. And we'll probably do some M&A as well.
So what does that really mean for the uninitiated? What is a capital raise, firstly? Yeah. Who are the investors?
Yep.
And have you ever met them in person?
Interesting question, Nick. What is capital raise? Capital is where you raise money to come into your company. Well, a company raises money as a capital raise, and that money can go to two things. It can either go to the shareholders for a stake in the company, or it can go into the business, and then the existing shareholders are diluted. And so that's what we've done, which is the latter one. So money has come into our company, or will be coming into our company, and therefore our existing shareholders are diluted.
So they kind of bought a stake.
They bought a stake. They bought a stake in the company. So in our case, they bought, I think it's 29% of the business they've come in. Who is our investor? It's a French family business, company called Genergy. Genergy is owned and run by one of the board members of the Decathlon sports retailer.
Yeah, wow.
So Decathlon's one of the world's largest global sports retailers. 60 million visitors go to Decathlon stores around the world every single month, or their websites. Very strong in Western Europe, China, India, Brazil, Russia. There's a couple of small stores down here now in Australia, which is great. It's a fantastic retailer. So great opportunity for Intrepid in strategically in the sense of a new customer market. And secondly, that ultimately they try and deliver happiness through sport. And now with our investor, they want to deliver happiness through sport and travel. So we'll increasingly be developing walking, cycling, fantastic sporting experiences, which we're very excited about. And Nick, have we met the investor? No, we are yet to meet in person, which is pretty crazy. So been talking for 7 or 8 months, 9 months now, and hoping to get to France or them to Australia as soon as we feasibly can. So it'll be interesting times.
So a pretty exciting partnership.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. No, it's super exciting. And I think, you know, that's what you want to keep evolving things, don't you? And keep moving forward. And what this will now, I think, bring to us strategically. Yeah, it's really exciting that we can really, you know, ultimately what Intrepid wants to do, our mission is to be the best travel company for the world. And if we want to be the best travel company for the world, then we need to do that beyond our core kind of sales markets and core operating businesses. And this gives us access to an enormous clientele to try and do that.
Well, mate, with you at the helm, I've got no doubt that you will be the best travel company in the world. James, thank you so much, mate, for spending some time with us on the Dolanders. It has been absolutely fascinating. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Blake. Thanks, Nick. Great to be here.
Thanks, Nick.
I really enjoyed that chat with James. Jeez, he's got his finger on the pulse, hasn't he?
Yeah, he does.
From the moment he wandered into the studio to the moment he wandered out, it was like he's on it. Hey, I was thinking, should we do a capital raise for the Dolanders?
Yes.
Who would invest in us?
Well, I think it's easier to sort of assume that who wouldn't invest. Yeah, so we probably need to put up some qualifiers there to make sure we just don't get inundated with requests for 29% of our podcast.
Yeah. Actually, I wonder if the French fella in charge of Decathlon.
Mr. and Mrs. Decathlon.
Yeah. Maybe they'd want to sponsor us.
Well, I'm wearing Decathlon right now. What are you wearing, Blake?
Yeah, of course I am.
It's very comfortable.
Of course I am. How impressive was James?
Yeah, and not only the age at which he was identified to join leadership groups and then obviously become CEO at such a young age, he just loves the industry. And I think we've heard that time and time again from our Dolanders who don't see it as work, really.
Yeah.
They're doing what they love to do, and great for them.
Yeah. That was the thing for me. So he was a private asset management private client asset management manager.
What is that?
What is that? Well, as he described, it's just making the rich richer, and thought, is this really meaningful? Is this good for my soul? And thought, what am I passionate about? I'm passionate about sport. I'm passionate about travel. Found a way into the travel industry. Thought, I'll do this for a couple of years and then move on. And that couple of years became 15, 16 years because he just loves what he does. And you can hear that in every word that he speaks about. The other thing that I really loved in terms of his approach was, we spoke about it. We both wrote it down when he said it was the way that he leads with casual intensity.
Oh, I love that. Going to get T-shirts made.
I think we should. Like, there is absolutely a T-shirt in casual intensity. That was cool. The other thing that I thought was cool, hungry, humble and smart.
Yeah.
That's what when they're recruiting at Intrepid, that's what they're looking for, people that are hungry, humble and smart. Would you say that you're hungry, humble and smart?
I am hungry a lot. If that's what you're asking. I think, you and I are values-led people and we see a lot of value in seeking out other people who are like-minded. So you can certainly see if you've got a leader who believes in recruiting the right people into the right roles at the right time, then you're going to have a great organisation.
You are. The other thing that is super cool is he's emotionally intelligent, self-aware, knows what he's good at and knows where his areas of opportunity are. He's said, okay, well, I'm not good at this, this and this. I'll go and find great people that are good at this, this and this, and great leaders do that.
Yep, they do. And that's James Thornton.
That it is. Talking about hungry, humble and smart.
Yeah.
I'm hungry. Let's go and...
on hungry, up next episode number 37, we have Jeremy Bettel, who is a director of high performance at a lot of the top sporting codes around the world, including the hockey, the basketball in America. And he talks to us about the way that old people like us or anyone in sport can actually look after themselves, not only from an exercise point of view, but also nutrition.
That's a beautiful segue.
Fantastic. I'm getting better at this.
You are amazing. Can't wait to speak to Jeremy. Until the next episode.
Bye for now, Blake.
Ciao.